Hello, this is Sharon Steitler, the bird chick, and I am here with non-birding Bill.
Hello.
And it is our goal to podcast.
All right.
And I bet you thought that goal had gone out the window just with how much lack of podcasting had been going on.
Certainly hope myself.
But I've been out pimping my wares out on the bird festival circuit.
All right.
But no, a lot of people listen to this podcast. I met quite a few.
Sure they do.
No, seriously. You have fans. The number of times someone came up to me and said, is Non-Birding Bill here with you at this festival? Because we want to go have a beer with him. No, he's not here at this festival.
This is not a character I do, folks. This is me.
I think that they think you're just going to be chilling in the hotel. Which is actually kind of what's going to be happening this summer. I just got the official word today that I'm going to be giving an iPhone digiscoping workshop at the British Bird Fair. Which is a life goal for me to go to Bird Fair. To be a presenter there is just... I'm so excited, but I'm also nervous because your presentation can't be more than 20 minutes.
You're going to be nervous because, I mean, you know, what happens is some guy accidentally rips off your skirt while he's trying to, like, pull a towel out. and then you have to run around in high speed. So make sure you're wearing your black stockings and garters when you...
No one gets the Benny Hill joke.
Of course they do. It's classic.
So. No, actually, me talking for 20 minutes, I don't know...
You don't know if you can talk for 20 minutes?
Oh, I can talk for 20 minutes, but, right. You know, just about iPhone to just...
They're going to have a big hook to pull you off the stage.
So, yeah, you will be... Well, actually, you'll be chilling in London while
I will not be at Bird Fair.
So. I wonder if we should try to have a London Birds and Beers.
I don't see
That's
why
pretty
not.
Much going to be every night for us in pubs. We're like really. Just having... So, but no, actually, it's interesting. People are listening to this podcast. It shocked me. There was someone who was interviewing me from the Allegheny Front, which I don't think that's gone up
yet. Is
that
a revolutionary group?
No, it's just NPR.
Oh, okay.
But it was a public radio thing, and she was really nice. We had a lot of fun. And I can't wait to hear it when it goes up. But she had listened to the podcast, and she was like, so you're not a feminist. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I know which podcast you've been listening to. I was like, it's not that I'm a feminist. It's just that, well, according to that BuzzFeed quiz, I'm problematic. But it's just, I take advantage of all the feminists who came before me, and I choose to live my life a certain way, and I understand there are consequences, but it's... Certainly, you know, I'm all for equal pay and all that stuff.
All right.
Anyway, just crack me up. Yeah, the question just kind of went there. It's like, so you're not a feminist. It's like, oh, is that... I am. Some people would disagree with that, but I am. Anyway, so, no, we've been having some adventures because I've been speaking at bird festivals and working on this thing called a web series, and you helped. You are a helper. You came with us to Texas.
Yep.
You got to meet Greg Miller.
I did.
And Greg Miller, for those who don't know, he is featured in the book The Big Year. If you saw the movie The Big Year, Greg Miller is played by Jack Black. And he's a super nice guy. And we ran into him at Estero Llano Grande. He's a really good sport because he is making a cameo in one of our episodes. I have to be very careful talking about the episodes because in my head, I refer to each episode by their clue. And so I find myself in public sometimes starting to talk about the blank episode. And it's like, I need to stop saying that. So if you haven't been watching the web series, you should.
Definitely.
You have a cameo in it.
Yes.
Actually, you have a few cameos in it.
I do.
But no, the web series is a lot of fun. It's basically what it is they're little 10-minute episodes. So you can like bank these up and save this for, you can like Netflix the crap out of this. But each episode has a clue and it's all based on the birds that we digiscoped in the episode. All the birds have something in common. And when you put all those clues together, that is the series theme. And if you correctly guess the series theme and email that to me, you are in a drawing for a spotting scope.
Now, I have to tell you, I've been watching like, we're getting some, you may have to clarify on this because we're getting some guesses already. And people are guessing what the theme of the series in general is. You're talking about like there's a code word.
Each episode, yes, there is a code word. It is a single word.
It's like, yeah, not like the theme is like bird watching or digiscoping.
No. The birds in each episode all have something in common.
Right.
And we'll reveal that in the final episode when we reveal the winner. But, yeah, so, you know, maybe watch a few episodes, but don't... And you can enter more than once. Like, if you, you know, send your guess now, and then you just realize, oh, crap, wait a minute. Because you're going to see more clues. But no, I and some people are getting what the clues are. Mm-hmm. Some people are not, and I'm fascinated by what people think some of the clues are. But, yeah, so it's a lot of fun, and you learn some digiscoping tips, and I like to think that there's a little bit of humor in there. And so my goal is that Swarovski and likes it, and all our other sponsors like it, and we can maybe keep doing these things, because I'm having so much fun putting them together. And we've had some great sponsors. We've had Swarovski, Princeton University Press, and I've gotten to know about some apps that are coming down the line. One of them is really super cool, and I'm not allowed to talk about it, and I'm really sad about that. And I even saw one of the guys who's working on the app. He showed me some of it on his phone at the Bird Festival I was just at in Michigan. And so I immediately emailed his publicist, and I was like, can I mention this? Can I? No, you can't mention it on the podcast yet. But the one I can mention, which we play with a little bit in the web series, is there's something called Bird Genie that's coming out. Mm-hmm. And Bird Genie is, it records the bird call, and it identifies it for you. And it's going to start out only doing, I think, 60 species, but they're going to add to it over time. But so far, it has about a 90% accuracy rate, so that's pretty cool.
Cool.
That's one of our sponsors. The Bird's Eye app, people, my favorite apps to use that help you find birds through eBird. Those are one of the sponsors. And actually, by the way, I have some app codes to give away. If you are someone who would like to have a copy of Bird's Eye North America for your iPhone, I have some codes. So the first five people who put in the subject line podcast and then tell me that you want this, we'll get it. And you have to email Sharon at birdchick.com.
Like right now?
The first five people, yeah, that hear this podcast.
All right.
So you can send it to me, and you know, if you're six and after, I will send you an email back saying, oh, thank you, but we already gave the codes away. Mm. But considering that people don't always listen to this as soon as it comes out, you have a very reasonable chance of... If you're listening to this a few days later. Now, if you're listening to this 2 weeks later, it'll be too late.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we have that.
And this is for iOS, right? You have to have an Apple iPhone or...
You have to have, iPad. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. So yeah, they're one of our sponsors. And then a tourism group in the Rio Grande Valley, South Texas Nature, they were our sponsors. They're a sponsor, as awesome. Is Keith of Alamo Inn Bed and Breakfast. So I could not believe how many sponsors I was able to get for this. When I pitched to people, it's like, hey, I want to make 8 episodes and do it as a contest. And I need some money for the travel and to kind of work on the editing. Do you want to be part of this? And everybody was like, yes. Everybody I asked all said yes. I know. It was great. Mm-hmm. And then I told Swarovski, and I want to give away one of your scopes, too. And they said yes. Mm. I'm drunk with birding power.
That's one of the things you're drunk with, yes. All right, let's get into the news. What do we have?
Well, I'm kind of behind on the news because a lot of stuff happened in our lack of podcasting. But one big thing that happened was there was a headline that was going around of a tree trimmer was trimming some trees where there's some black crowned night herons nesting. Mm. And it was in the parking lot of the U.S. Postal Service. And the tree trimmer apparently, allegedly, was throwing the nests and chicks into a wood chipper as they were tearing down the branches. So, of course, everyone was outraged and upset. U.S. Fish and Wildlife stepped in. One of the parts that I thought was cool about the story was the neighbors who lived in the neighborhood saw this was happening, and they got really angry. Mm-hmm. And they were telling the tree trimmer, you have to stop. There are birds nesting in these trees. You cannot trim. Mm-hmm. And the tree trimmer tried to keep going, saying, hey, Postal Service contacted me to doing this because the birds are crapping on their mail trucks. And the neighbors started calling police, and the police made them stop. And I thought that was just a really great grassroots movement of these neighbors saying, these birds are important, you're breaking the law. Mm-hmm. So there's been an investigation with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Some of the birds were kicked out of the nest, and the birds that were still alive after coming out of the nest went to a wildlife rehabilitation facility. But no birds ended up in the wood chipper.
Good.
Nests did, but not with baby birds in them. And the tree trimmer is really upset. He did an interview with the San Francisco Gate saying, you know, he was really sorry about it. He's already contributed some money, and when he gets the money from the Postal Service for the work he started to do, he's going to give that to the rehab facility to pay for the bird care.
Good.
So, yeah, he's offered to pay $2,700 towards the bird's care. He's already, I believe, given him $500.
Okay.
And he's really, really sorry. And he's just come out and said, you know, I love birds. I didn't realize that there were this many nests in the tree. I never put any of the birds in the wood chipper. And so he's really trying hard to do the right thing. Because I was kind of concerned because, you know, when you link to stories like these, people get very passionate about it.
Yeah.
And you see some comments that are sometimes, shall I say, over the top.
I don't see any comments at all.
Well, that's because you don't read comments.
No, but I have a thing on my computer specifically to block me from.
You know, when I post things to the Bird Chick page on Facebook, I have to read the comments because, you know, people are commenting. You know, it's all part of this whole social interaction thing on social media.
Ah, I say.
You know, it's not called Bill Media. It's called social media.
Yeah, I think it is. I think I like the arrangement I've set up just fine.
So anyway, and so I just want everyone to know, if you saw that story and you thought this was a horrible person, he is genuinely remorseful, and none of the birds actually ended up in the wood chipper, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Investigation. Right. So, yay! So speaking of social media, right. I was like, so right as spring migration was starting and I was going to all these bird festivals, I was just so excited and so full of joy because I would go and I'm looking at Facebook and I'm just seeing all these pictures. People are posting pictures of warblers and getting excited and things like this. And I'm just thinking, what a great age we live in where, you know, something that I didn't have as a kid, but, you know, a kid now can go onto their Facebook page. And if they follow bird watchers, they are going to see really great photos of birds.
Oh, yeah.
And birds are going to show up. And you just get these really fantastic pictures of birds. And now I'm kind of to the point on social media. It's like, everybody, please stop posting pictures of your birds, including me. And I'm just as bad. But, I mean, I limit my social media posting of bird photos to my Instagram account. And, yeah, it'll go to my Facebook and it'll go to my Twitter. But these are my pages. And so I feel like, you know, I'm gonna show my pictures.
Right. That's it exactly.
Like over the weekend, I'm not a member of very many Facebook birding pages, but I know this is something universal that's going around. The few that I am a part of, they keep repinning their Facebook page rules saying, hey, new members, maybe read the rules. And I just want to emphasize, maybe don't post like albums of all your bird photos and things like that. And it's just, so I was like, maybe we should create a drinking game. Where every time the admin of a birding page reposts the rules, you have to take a drink. And if anything is in bold, you have to take two drinks.
Well, I told you about, that's just the thing that happens when people rejoin groups or when, you know, like a thing, or like people join a group, is that, you know, there's always this sensation of you have to.
What was that thing you were telling me about, the September effect?
Permanent September. Yeah, it was a thing back when the internet was, and like Usenet and like news groups and stuff.
We're going to be those people that tell kids, I remember back when the internet was just for the academics.
Yeah, I remember having to go to the head of the computer science department and explain why I needed an email address. But, no, it's a thing, like, September was always the, you know, everybody who was already on the group dreaded September because that's when all the freshmen came in, and you had to explain what the rules, netiquette, you know, how to behave on the group and, like, the questions they've already asked and stuff. And then at a point where it became, you know, the internet became sort of ubiquitous with AOL and all these other services that made it easy to use, it was this, somebody said, it's permanent September, we're going to have to explain this forever.
It is. Well, and Facebook is also kind of permanent Thanksgiving, because now that all our family members are on there, we all have to be on
our
best.
Not for me.
Because you unfriended half your family.
I unfriended so many. I decided to just... And I love Facebook so much more now. It's awesome. It doesn't have to be like Thanksgiving.
If you unfriend your family members.
I'm sure they don't want to hear from me. I'm sure I annoy them just as much. I'm making things better for everybody.
That's what I tell people, because I have a public page and I have a private page. And people I don't know, or maybe just met casually in exchange maybe two sentences with, and they want to friend me on my personal page. I'm like, I'm really obnoxious. You do not want to friend me. Stay on the Bird Chick page, because that's where I talk about birds. But on my personal page, you might get some inappropriate material.
Right.
I swear on my personal Facebook page. Yeah. So, anyway.
The devil you say.
I know, right? I know that's shocking to believe that bird watchers swear, but... I'm going to stop talking about swearing.
I say we've been pretty clean so far, this one.
I know. Well, the podcast we don't swear in. And usually
I do.
No, we've gotten... That explains that conversation I had.
Yeah. All right, what's our next story?
Our next story that we are going to talk about. Can you tell that I've lost it as I try to?
Yeah, as you try scrolling
through. What we'll talk about is if we're talking about new birders, and I just want to go back to that thing. If you're someone that's taking a lot of pictures of birds and they're fantastic, start an Instagram account. That's where everybody wants to go to look at photos. Mm-hmm. Don't be bent out of shape that your birding Facebook page is like, we don't want to look at all your pictures of cardinals.
Or you can like create a gallery on Flickr and then just link to the gallery. And if somebody wants to go to see all of the photos, they can.
Because inevitably what happens, and we have this kind of interesting morph happen on the Minnesota Birding Facebook page, because it's one thing to say, I'm starting to see warblers, or I'm starting to see this migrant come back. But then when you start getting 20 photos of a catbird, it gets to be a problem. And
right.
And then, like, someone who has, like, somebody had a picture of a warbler hybrid. And so posts like that can get lost if people keep posting catbird pictures. So, you know, just kind of keep in mind of what your page's guidelines are. And if you take a lot of photos, I know it is so much fun to get those likes. Put it on Instagram. That's where everybody goes to like stuff.
Right.
It's designed for you to share your photos. And what's really cool about Instagram, and I know some people are listening to this podcast saying, wait a minute, didn't you talk about how much you hated Instagram? You know what? If you have a bad bird photo and you just put an Instagram filter on it, non-birders think you're the coolest thing ever. They think it is the best photo ever. So start Instagram. If you follow me on Instagram, I'll follow you back. Because I use Instagram to waste time when I'm waiting in line. I look at people's stuff. I'm fascinated by what people take pictures of.
Yep.
Did I tell you somebody has created a dead birds Facebook page?
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
And all you do is you post pictures of dead birds.
That's great.
And you can put commentary in there, and you can even ask, what did this used to be? What's this the foot of?
Sure.
Or how do you think this bird died? So if you're like me and you like looking at dead birds, join the dead bird Facebook page.
Junior Serial Killers Association.
No, it's fascinating. You learn a lot of stuff. As a matter of fact, I just found a dead gull when I was in Michigan at Presque Isle. That's not the coolest. No, that wasn't Presque Isle. Presque Isle was in Pennsylvania. All these things are running together. I was in Tawas Point. We found a dead gull, and I was looking at it because it was near a fox den, and I wanted to see if you could see evidence of the fox shredding the feathers because I wanted to get pictures of it. It was really sad. The gull had been eaten by a fox, but what killed it or what contributed to its death was it was wound up in a fishing line.
You sure the fox didn't garrot it?
I don't think the foxes are crafty, but I don't think they're that crafty. So, you know.
Throwing suspicion off of itself.
So, no, you know, Thomas Point was a really great bird festival. And I think what we're going to have to do on the Bird Chick page once I finish with this web series is I want to create a page and give, like, mini reviews of all the bird festivals I've been to. And I'm not going to give reviews that was like, oh, man, this festival was a waste of time. I can't believe they even bothered putting it on. Because I've yet to be at a bird festival that was like that. But as I'm traveling to all these different bird festivals, Thomas Point, it was like South Padre Island during migration, but a little colder. And so if the idea of the biggest week in birding intrigues you just for the amount of birds that you can see, but the number of people freaks you the heck out, then Tawas Point is the place to go. Because there aren't as many people. And even if there were, there's plenty of room to spread. It's not like you're jam-packed in on that boardwalk. But Tawas Point was a fantastic bird festival.
All right.
And then the Presque Isle Bird Festival that was in Erie, Pennsylvania, that was a lot of fun. And also, I'll say this for the other bird festival. I was at the Red Slough Bird Festival in Oklahoma. Both of them are warbler festivals. You're getting different types of warblers and different types of birds. But they limit the number of people who can come in. And they're okay with being small bird festivals. Oh, okay. You know, some bird festivals, like, we want 600 people. We want 1,000 people coming. These were like, yeah, we're really okay. We kept this off at about 120.
Okay.
So if you want that small, intimate, tiny town experience, these are really cool bird festivals to go to. So that's why I'm thinking I might start doing, like, just like mini reviews say, this is what you should do for this festival.
Okay.
And I was also thinking, like, things like the North Dakota Potholes and Prairie Bird Festival, that's a good festival. If I were going to do that festival, I would plan extra days outside of the festival. And if it's a rainy day and you're supposed to be on a field trip, I would just eat that money and not go on the field trip. And then use one of the extra days to just do that part on your own. Because there is nothing more miserable than trying to go on a bird tour on the prairie. Because you're in the bus. Mm. Every time the bus moves, it gets mud on the windows.
Sure.
You're standing out in the rain trying to look at a sparrow.
Okay.
And it's the sparrow doesn't want to stand up in the rain. You don't want to stand out in the rain and look at the sparrow. What you want is you want the experience when it's not raining and the The sunlight is hitting that Barred Sparrow perfectly, and while it's singing its quite melodic song for a sparrow, you have a sprig. What else would it be?
Melodic.
You say melodic, I say melodic.
I love it when songs have a great melody.
Plover plover. Anyway, Perula perula. So, and then, you know, you have this Sprague's Pippet singing, and then it dives down. And that's the experience you want to have. If it's raining at the Potholes and Prairie, just sleep in that day. I'm serious.
Okay.
It's miserable. I don't like going bird watching in the rain unless I'm paid for it by a wind farm company that's giving me a lot of money to sit out in that rain.
All right.
But, anyway, that's something I was thinking we'd do. Oh! I know the segue I was going to do with this.
Oh, great. I hope that wasn't it, because that was a really terrible segue.
It is a terrible segue. I was going to talk about...
Considering everything is about birds, I don't think it would be that hard to come up with a segue.
Well, I was thinking... I'm trying to decide if I want to go to news or just talk about the books that I just got. And I in my head, this had a route. It was a circuitous route, but it was a route. So I was talking about beginning birders and maybe... Or just people new to birding pages and don't post all your photos and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So I get this pile of books when I come home. Because people send me books because they want me to talk about them. Yeah. I definitely want to get the books because I enjoy reading books. So I have like this influx of bird books coming in that are just geared at beginning bird watchers. It's like all the authors we know have all been thinking, we need to make better books for beginners. And it's fascinating to me because the American Birding Association is now coming out with state-by-state guides.
Okay.
And they're written by hardcore birders.
Sure.
And what's really funny is a hardcore birder is making a field guide for what they think a beginner wants to know.
Okay.
And it's like they organize the birds taxonomically. And it's like, guys, these are really cool books. They're intermediate books at best. These are not beginner bird books. Right. Because a beginner is going to look at this book and be like, I saw a yellow bird and it was small. And they're going to go through the book, and then it's yellow birds are all over the place. And they're going to be like, what's the difference between a warbler and a finch?
Sure.
So they're cool guides. Right now they just have one for Colorado and one for New Jersey. I'm sure it's going to be all the birdiest.
Interesting choice. I mean, I know that like New Jersey is like a birding hotspot. I wouldn't think. Is Colorado a birding?
Well, that's where the ABA is located right now. Okay, so that's why you're going to have that one there. I'm actually kind of curious to see who's going to be the authors of each individual states.
Oh, okay.
Because Rick Wright, I think, is the one for New Jersey, which I think he lives there now. He lived in Arizona. He'll probably end up doing the Arizona one. And then Ted Floyd, who edits a bunch of publications for the ABA, he did Colorado. But, you know, it's like, who's going to do Texas?
Yeah. It would almost seem like with the really big states that it would be make more sense to, like, do it by region. Although, I don't know anything about birds, so I guess. Like, California, it occurs to me, like, you know, California has, like, a bunch of different...
Yeah, you'd want to do it by different habitats.
Like, biomes or...
Well, and that was the thing, like, I've said for years, and I will maintain, these books will... The Kella guides, the little state-by-state guides, that are organized by color.
Right.
They are going to outsell all these other bird books, because... It's something for someone who does not know how to watch birds or know anything about birds. It's approachable, and they're like, oh, this makes sense to me. And one of the criticisms that I know the Minnesota one has had is like, well, these birds are mostly Twin Cities birds. These birds don't necessarily apply if I live up in Duluth. But you have to look at the market. But they have several birds in there. They're really good guides. If you know someone who is just starting birding and they have the Tekela guide, I would say the ABA guides are going to be a step up from that for sure.
Sure.
But, I mean, unless you already know the difference between a warbler and a finch, these are going to be... They're good guides. They're just... I wouldn't call them beginner guides. I'd call them
intermediate. Are they photographic
guides.
Or are they...
They are photographic.
Okay.
They are photographic, which when I started birding, I found photographs far more approachable than illustrations.
Oh, sure.
And the reason why is, and it's interesting because the argument is, well, with an illustration, you can pose the bird so you can see all the right field marks. Whereas in my brain, it's like... That bird doesn't look like that in the wild, so I don't know. I get my brain imprints on seeing every single field mark.
Yeah, I can see that, like, illustrations, once you have a general idea, and once you have a better idea of, like, what birds look like, it will help you distinguish between two similar birds.
Yeah. I would be hesitant to give this to someone who said, I think I want to start bird watching. Right. I would give this to someone who says, you know, I started doing this thing called birding, and this weekend... Based on this book...
I came up with this word. I call it birding.
I saw a kingbird this weekend. So if you hear someone like that, or if it's a kid who already has an interest in birds, then getting right. him that state. And it's a moot point at the moment because there's only two states out. But now the other book that I got that I thought was fascinating. Okay, so Bill Thompson had that Young Birders Guide.
Mm-hmm.
They have taken that
right.
and they've changed the cover to say New Birders Guide.
Mm-hmm.
And they took out the picture of the kid wearing the birding clothes right. and they put Bill in there wearing birding clothes. And it's practically the same book.
Oh, that makes sense.
Well, and I had heard people say, I really love that book, but I don't want to walk around carrying a bird guide that says it's for
yeah,
kids.
My first bird book.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You open it up and it plays Barney. And
and I have to say, as far as like a beginning bird book, I think that one is fantastic. I would still prefer, mm-hmm. for someone who doesn't know birds, that it be organized by color.
Sure.
But I mean, it has like, you know, I think for someone who doesn't know very much about birds and they want to get into it, you open that book and it's like, oh, here's a cool fact about the bird. It has mm-hmm. both illustrations and it'll show you like key behaviors. I was looking at, yeah, one of the state guides. It shows black and white warbler. And in both the black and white warbler pictures, it's perched on a branch. And typically when you see a black and white warbler, it's creeping around on a tree,
okay.
like a brown creeper would. Like around a tree trunk. And so all of these, I just want to emphasize, they're all really good books. I would say that the New Birders Guide is a little bit better for beginners.
So let me ask you this. Let's take the stuff of like that's out now and the yeah. people you know. What's the worst bird book you've ever seen? Because I know you've got some real barkers because I bought them for you. I used to prowl around the secondhand bookstores.
I know, but some of those are like religious bird books. I feel bad about doing this because now that people actually listen to this podcast, I know how hard it is to write a book.
I'm talking about like the Nagelty stuff, the, you know.
Well, that's not necessarily bad. That's just things were different at the time.
All right.
I mean, I love those books. I actually was talking. My agent's going to kill me. I wouldn't mind republishing that with kind of some essay saying this is how this is different because sure. we don't categorize birds as good and evil anymore.
Right.
But I mean, there are some barkers out there. But the problem is, I have a lot of friends who need to get paid to write stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want to necessarily say that their book is a barker.
No, I'm not talking about the stuff that's out now or the people that you know. I mean, I would never put you in that position. I'm talking about like the old bird books, because I know you have like a ton of them.
But even the ones that are bad, I love, because for the time they made sense. Because
I mean, you talk about, I mean, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, is like Audubon, they talk about Audubon being like really realistic, and he didn't.
Oh.
He posed the birds in like ways okay. that they would never actually be.
You know, actually, what we should do is... No. Okay, so here's the way you need to think about Audubon. If you ever saw the movie Amadeus...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know you had the whole Mozart and Salieri thing?
Sure.
Audubon is Mozart.
Okay.
Salieri is Alexander Wilson.
Okay.
And we have an Alexander Wilson.
Okay.
And the more I read about them, because I have biographies for both, although...
Of course you do.
Tom Cran at Minnesota Public Radio from All Things Considered has my Audubon biography right sure. now. I'm calling you out, Tom. You're going to give that back to me someday. But no, Alexander Wilson was like this tortured poet artist who struggled with depression.
Right.
And he also was very scientific minded. And he had this goal to try and portray birds scientifically and accurately and to get birds in a field guide. And so he's out selling subscriptions to his guide. He has this chance meeting in Kentucky with some French guys who own a shop. And he's trying to get them to buy his book. And he's trying to sell these subscriptions to fund his trip so he can keep painting all these birds. And the style at the time was that you had this kind of lifeless bird that was just posed so you could see all the field marks.
Right.
And this French guy was like, okay, maybe I will buy this guide from you. You know, this is not bad. And then the guy that's in the shop with him says something in French, which is basically, you know, my friend, you should not buy this book because your illustrations are 10 times better.
Whispering in French is
okay.
really great.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that.
So, my friend, Audubon, you should not buy these books. You should just paint your home.
This is...
Yeah, okay, anyway. So...
I presume he was like holding a baguette and had a cigarette dangling out of his mouth while he was wearing a striped shirt and a beret at the same time.
There was someone in the corner with a little...
A concertina?
A concertina playing.
Yeah.
Alouette, Jean-Pierre,
yeah,
exactly. Alouette.
And they had like rows of onions hanging. Yeah, that's...
So it's this chance meeting, and Audubon looks at Alexander Wilson's thing, and you can just like see Alexander Wilson with his little stiff collar up and be like, this is a very suspicious meeting that I'm having with these French guys, but I'm going to keep going out and selling my book. And then Audubon's like, I've been painting these birds and I'm going to keep doing it. And he develops this technique where he brings life and passion, often inaccurate life and passion, to these birds. Although some of them are quite nice. The Carolina parakeets are actually quite accurate.
Okay.
And he starts painting everything. Audubon was just kind of a hot mess, because then he went to all of Wilson's colleagues to try and sell subscriptions to his book and was just saying, this is why Wilson sucks. Look at my paintings, they show birds in real life and how they're going to be and blah, blah, blah. And Wilson, he's kind of like stiff. Audubon unfortunately did this with like one of Wilson's best supporters. And they were just like, we are cutting you off. It was just like a records committee thing. It's like, you're dead to us. We are not going to accept any of your records. We are not going to accept your book. And so Audubon was like, well, crap. You know what? I'm going to go to Europe, and I'm going to stop wearing my big fancy flowery shirts and my cuffs, and I'm going to take my long hair, and I'm going to like make it all bushy, and then I'm going to go over to Europe, and I'm going to take my French accent, and now I'm going to add in some Southern charm into it, and then he becomes this mountain man, and everyone's just like, oh my gosh, you're so fun, you're so charming, you're so awesome, your birds are so lifelike, I've never experienced anything like it, and then, yeah, this whole thing, and... There was even, like, you know, the ruffed grouse print that we have?
Yeah.
That is an official Alexander Wilson, which I wowed someone at a museum with.
Right.
That is one that Audubon is supposed to have copied. And, like, you can, like, see the Audubon where you can see how it was traced, only it's backwards.
Oh.
So that ours is part of a controversial piece of history. Anyway. Someone should make a movie kind of like Amadeus, only about bird watching, with Alexander Wilson and John James Audubon. Sure,
based on the massive success of Big Year, they're going to get right on that.
Actually, Big Year is really quite successful.
The movie?
It didn't have like opening box office success, but you know, just post.
Boffo-B-O.
It wasn't Boffo-B-O, but it is acceptable money. It's. I'm not saying it's Midnight Madness quality, but.
God. All right. What's our next news story? We've
Pour me another drink.
Okay. And we're back.
Okay, so while you were pouring me that drink, I was just glancing at Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And so earlier today, I did... So Audubon Magazine has... This month, everybody's talking about the passenger pigeon, because it's the 100th anniversary of how we killed the passenger pigeon.
The extinction of the passenger pigeon.
Yeah. So I was reading that article, and then it comes with this foldable bird.
Right.
It's supposed to be kind of like origami, and it's supposed to kind of look like a passenger pigeon when you're done with it. The instructions are a little hard to understand.
Okay.
And so I just kind of was like, here's mine. And then somebody just posted, like, look, my 7-year-old son did it. And it's like, it looks way better than mine. Anyway, that article I was reading about the extinction of the passenger pigeon was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And it also got me thinking, we were just talking about Audubon. You know, when Audubon was alive, birds were completely different. They were.
They were as tall as buildings. One ruled the South for 4 years under the French government. His name was Gritor. How are birds completely different?
Well, okay, first you have these massive flocks of passenger pigeons. Have you ever read accounts of this?
Birds? Several times. They blocked out the sun.
That's the supposed thing. Or, you know, they sounded like, you know, freight trains. And there's one account of, like, you know, some town... probably not the most educated town ever, but you know, people were dropping down in the streets and praying because this big cloud was coming at them.
That I don't, you know, that I'm always suspicious of. That's like people telling you, when they put movies on, when they made moving pictures, people ran out of the theaters because they thought a train was going to run them over, because people had no depth perception back then.
What?
Anyway,
so they were talking about that, and I mean, so, you know, I was just kind of reading the article following that, and it talked about the groups that are trying to reintroduce or trying to recreate the passenger pigeon.
Okay.
And they're trying to do that with like a base of a band-tailed pigeon, and then they're going to take this DNA from, I'm assuming they're going to find some kindly museum that's going to be like, well, yes, you can take this tissue sample of our passenger pigeon and go all Jurassic Park on us. And the group's founder has this plan. It's like, yeah, we're going to initially breed them and then keep them in captivity, and you know, our plans are in 2030 is when we'll start releasing them to the wild. And I read that, and I'm like, whoa. You can't just start releasing the passenger pigeon into the wild if you bring it back. Okay, and I granted, anyone out here with any kind of genetic background that's just saying, well, now, bird chick, let's just talk about the feasibility of actually making this happen. Let's skip some of those steps. And feel free to email me and tell me that my fears are allayed. We're not going to do that. But you can't just release some recreated species out in the wild.
Why not?
Okay, so let's go back to like the passenger pigeon being in these gigantic flocks. Mm-hmm. That would just come and devastate crops or just take over a woodland.
Right.
Our ecosystem has lived without passenger pigeons for 100 years. Granted, that's not a lot of time. But we have taxed it in so many ways as far as how we have eaten up habitat with buildings and blah, 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 blah. You suddenly introduce this voracious flock of passenger pigeons out in the wild. What's that going to do to the birds that haven't had to deal with them for a long time? Are they going to be eating resources that are valuable for birds that are already on the brink?
Maybe passenger pigeons will push out the sparrows.
Or starlings. What if they push out the cerulean warbler? Hmm? What if they push out the Canada warbler? What if that's the thing that...
What if it's a birdemic and they start crashing into
gas
stations?
Well, there is that. I mean, we all have read Jurassic Park or at least saw the movie. It didn't turn out well.
I wouldn't bring up Jurassic Park or your other fantastic reason, blah, blah, blah. When you're testifying before the House Subcommittee.
Isn't that what Neil deGrasse Tyson does on Cosmos?
Hey, blah, blah, blah.
So we have this whole solar system thing, blah, 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 blah.
He does the little squawky hand thing, which you can't see here, the yappity-yap hand.
But I'm just thinking, I mean, here's a bird that hasn't been in the ecosystem for a while. And,
I agree.
You know, we're just going to put that back out into this habitat. They're going to breed like crazy, maybe, sort of, kind of.
I don't know. I mean, you cannot predict. That's an interesting question. What are the ethics of reintroducing a species into a system? Because, like, we talked about this before. In England, the sparrow, or, like, in Europe, the house sparrow is endangered.
Yes.
And I was like, well, what happens if we, you know, take a bunch of American house sparrows and take them back over there, because maybe they're hardier for living over here. Is that going to change?
There are all sorts of things about just bringing species over now. You know, because they would have to be quarantined and all this stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's...
They might have mad cow disease.
Yeah, I mean, are there laws that govern, like, the introduction of species?
Yes.
Okay. But that's, like, a foreign species. And this is, like... Well, that's interesting. Well, I mean, that raises an interesting question, because, I mean, they can't sort of, I mean, they can't, I okay, and granted, I'm a theater major, so I know crap about what I'm talking about here. I presume that, you know, like you say, they're going to have to find some living creature to...
They're going to start with band-tailed pigeons.
Right, so this is not going to be, strictly speaking...
They're going to get it as close to a passenger pigeon as they can, but it's and I was trying to follow what the guy was saying, because he was like, well, you know, if I show this to a scientist, he's like, well, how much of this is real passenger? It's going to be interesting for bird listing, but regardless of that, you do have people who introduce stuff now. I mean, there's nothing that could stop someone who knew how to smuggle birds that really loved house sparrows into taking a whole bunch of United States house sparrows and trying to smuggle them into the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And no one would really know that would be happening if they didn't catch the people smuggling them in. And bird smuggling is possible. We see it happen all the time. Like when guys go through and then get caught with a bunch of hummingbirds in their pants.
Right.
But, and we have it here. There's clearly someone who's releasing European species in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. We saw a blue tit.
Neil's backyard.
But it's not taking.
But if U.S. Fish and Wildlife knew someone was purposely releasing species, they would try to stop that.
Oh, yeah.
There's clearly someone who's trying to do that, because if you look at bird records for European species like blue tit, great tit, and European goldfinch, there's a lot that are reported in Illinois, southern Wisconsin, southern Minnesota.
Well, here's an interesting... I mean, this is,
you
know...
But you can't catch them.
So, I mean, this is interesting, because, I mean, is this okay at all? I mean, it's like we're trying to reintroduce the wolf, you know, in Minnesota and, you know, other places. And we talked about the last time, you know, the effect that the sort of positive effect that reintroducing the wolf was having in Yellowstone. But these creatures weren't extinct, but they were part of a managed population that was reintroduced to this area that they had been driven out of.
Yeah. And but they hadn't been gone that long. Mm. And the thing is, we're not... And there were some unknown factors with the wolf. Let's be clear with that. My concern is we're talking about a bird that was known to be a voracious breeder.
Mm-hmm.
That was known to have these gigantic populations that would just come and eat the crap out of everything.
Yeah.
If we unleash something like that to an environment that's incredibly taxed and hasn't had to deal with that for a long time, is it going to wreak havoc?
Or, I mean, is the European house sparrow filling the void that bird left?
I don't think the European house sparrow is doing that. You know, I think I've referenced this before in the podcast. I read an article years ago put out by the Bell Museum, and it correlated the extinction of the passenger pigeon with the increase of Lyme disease. Or the prevalence of Lyme disease.
Okay.
And the thinking was that these pigeons would go and look for oak mast. And those are the years when oak trees just have a buttload of acorns that hit the ground. And they would come in and they would eat all this oak mast. And because the flocks were so large, they ate it quickly and it would disappear. So without the passenger pigeon, you now have to rely on all these other creatures like deer and mice and smaller birds. And they take longer to eat it. And because it's taking longer, that has allowed mice, deer mice in particular, and the deer tick and deer to commingle and create this kind of petri dish to allow for more ticks to have to carry the Lyme disease. And it was really fascinating the way the person had laid it out to when the passenger pigeon went extinct, when people started showing up with Lyme disease symptoms. And I'm not saying that this was just a theory. This was not fact. Sure. But I was like, that's fascinating.
Well, here's the question is, in your opinion, is there any safe way to do this? Because, I mean, like when we, you know, reintroduce wolves to a population, wolves are on the ground. And you can sort of, I mean, and they can tag them and sort of track where they're going. Birds fly. They can go anywhere they want.
We had wild wolf populations at that point. And we could say, this wolf population over here, X, Y, and Z is happening.
Mm-hmm.
We need to prepare for X, Y, and Z if we're going to release that in Minnesota. We don't have any frame of reference anywhere for 100 years of what passenger pigeons are like. And let's keep in mind, stuff that was written 100 years ago, those are like my Nijelty books. Those are my crazy... Those are Forbush and May. That was back when we had very different opinions about birds. And we also tended to write with exaggeration and flowery language. We have some ideas of what the passenger pigeon was like, but there's quite a bit... We don't really know that much about their breeding
cycle. So are you opposed to the cloning of these birds under any circumstances? Because, I mean, even
that's if that's a good question.
Because there's no, unless we release them into the wild, we're going to have no sense of what, I mean, you can't, because, I mean, you can't release them into, unless you do it in, like we went to the Cleveland Zoo and they had that huge zone, that huge dome where you can keep the birds from escaping.
You can't.
To observe what they're going to do.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure how I feel about this. And there's also the thing to be said that, If they find a way to bring back some remarkable facsimile of a passenger pigeon, will that communicate to coming generations, something's going extinct, we'll just recreate it later.
Mm.
And then that kind of takes value away of, we don't have to worry about conserving this bird, because if it goes extinct, we'll find a way to get something kind of like it again.
All right.
That got heavy.
Yeah. Next story.
I don't know. How long has this podcast been going? Because we've talked a lot.
43 minutes.
Okay. Maybe. Okay, I'm not going to talk about all the other stories I had planned. I'm just going to end on... The New York Times has been talking about bird watchers a lot this week.
Sure.
They've had stuff like... Lily Taylor was interviewed because she was talking about watching birds on top of the Empire State Building. I need to do that sometime. You don't necessarily identify the birds, but you're watching them as they're flying over and migrating. So that's a pretty cool article. But then it had this whole thing of like, it's gadgets versus eyeballs as two species of bird watchers clash.
Oh, God.
And it's this article that's trying to, you know, pit tech birders like myself against, you know, the Luddite birders who don't go out. And they interview Pete Dunne. And
okay, are we talking about people who use binoculars?
Mm-hmm.
That's technology, okay? Do you have any idea how much work goes into... Just because there's no...
Actually, I do, because I've been to the Swarovski factory in Austria.
Exactly my point is, like, just because electricity is not flowing through it, it's like the people who talk about, like, oh, bicycling is so green. Your bike came out of a factory.
Chances are good your bike came out of a Chinese factory.
That metal was mined and processed, and smoke came out of chimneys for your bicycle. So if you are using, you know, binoculars, you are not... Yeah, all right. So continue with your story.
But I felt like this article tried to... Because they interviewed Pete Dunne, who's the founder of the World Series of Birding. And they tried to make him sound like, I don't like using technology with my stuff, you know.
Don't whisper. That doesn't work.
Oh, that's just the old man voice. But they made him sound like, you know, I eschew using an app when I'm out in the field. And that's not Pete Dunne. Pete Dunne may not carry his cell phone when he goes out bird watching. He may want that, you know, just be cut off and just enjoy the bird calls. I don't think he hates apps and technology. And then they were saying that, well, you know, he doesn't allow you to use that in the World Series of Birding. And I'm like, well, that's because the World Series of Birding is a game. And there are specific rules, and everybody has to follow those rules. If you don't like that you can't use a bird app to find something out, create your own World Series of Birding. You know, create your own birding contest.
Yeah, but I mean, even in the World Series of Birding, there's like a digiscoping team.
I don't think they have that anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway,
there may be just a general photography thing. You know, Clay and I won it, and then they just pretty much decided it's done.
No one's going to do it better, and that was it.
You can try to do it better, but Clay and I are so awesome at digiscoping.
Well, no, I mean, okay, obviously this is a news story, and they're trying to, I mean, that's, conflict is always interesting. It's rather than saying, hey, nobody cares what you do when you're going bird watching. It's much more interesting to say there's an old school and a new school.
Well, it's fascinating to me, because when I was in Tawas Point this weekend, I ran into John Dunn, who's the author of the National Geographic Field Guide. Okay. Who was there leading a bird trip, and I was showing him, I had such terrible Wi-Fi in my hotel, so in the breakfast nook area, you had decent Wi-Fi, so I'm trying to upload the episode of our web series.
Right.
And everyone's like, oh, hey, what you got going on there? And so I'm showing them, like, some iPhone digiscoping stuff, which ended up being an iPhone digiscoping workshop, and the episode got uploaded late, but that was okay. But John was talking to me, he was like, you know, I see people in restaurants, and they're not talking to each other, and they're looking at their phones, or I just find it so rude when I'm talking to someone, and they suddenly start looking at their phone.
Right.
I said, you know, I said, I definitely keep categories in my head of people I can go out with, and it's okay for me to look at my phone, and people I go out with, and they are going to be incredibly offended if I whip out my phone, or if I even keep my phone on the table. And he said, it's just so rude. I mean, what's the point if you're going out somewhere and you're not looking at each other and you're looking at the phone? And I said, now keep in mind, if Bill and I are out at a restaurant and we're using our phones, chances are we're gossiping about someone that's talking very loudly next to us and we're just sharing those observations back and forth.
Exactly.
I was like, you know what? I remember when we moved to the Twin Cities and we would go to Sunnyside Up, that cafe that used to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And you would see couples in the morning reading the newspaper together.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh gosh, I don't want to be that couple that doesn't talk. But boy, really, you just kind of run out of things to say after 16 years of marriage.
Don't need to chit-chat all the damn time, people. Come on.
But, you know, the phones are... And I feel like even when we're on our phones, we actually are still chatting because I'll forward you something or you'll post something to my Facebook wall or... Or we'll just start texting and gossiping about a conversation that's going on next to us and whether or not those people are breaking up or are on a first date.
Okay.
But anyway, I think it's great that the New York Times is acknowledging birdwatching. I do think there are, you know, some definite things to talk about, technology versus non-technology. But hey, you know what? If you enjoy walking out in the woods with no cell phone and just your binoculars and that's how you get your rocks off watching birds, that's fantastic. And you know what? If you're someone who, you know, really loves to digiscope with a smartphone and send that stuff to Instagram and Twitter, and then, you know, have all your field guides on your smartphone, and then you have the Merlin app, and that's how you figure out ID, that's great, too. Don't poo-poo each other about it.
Right. I don't disagree. I have no disagreement about this.
I just think the New York Times is trying to make us angry at it. And I'm sure there's probably some people out
there. There's always, you know, people always think that their way is the right way, you know.
But my way is the wrong way, and I assume everybody else is doing it wrong. Nobody cares. Well, there are definitely people who care, but it's like, come on. You wanted more bird watchers. This is how the bird watchers are going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Except the one thing I will universally agree on is if your Facebook birding page has specific rules about photos, don't post your photos on that page.
All right.
I don't want to talk. There are more stories, but that's all I want to talk about. Okay. I know what number this is if you don't.
I do. I always know what this is.
How do you know?
Because I number them when I create the audio file. Oh. And I have to increase it by one.
Yeah, but how do you remember what the one we did previous when it's been several weeks?
Because I keep the file until I have to replace it.
Oh my gosh. So I have to tell you about something that happened. So if I am your tech person, you are in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so I am very familiar with giving. I do, when I give presentations, I do them as PowerPoint slideshows. Let me be clear. I'm not reading to you everything that's on the slideshow. I just reading the text that's on the PowerPoint.
Yep.
That's just how I show pictures. And my pictures are my outline. And so I have become very familiar with when PowerPoint goes right and when PowerPoint goes wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I was at One Bird Festival over the last few weeks, everyone was just freaking out because Julie Sikafoos had done a presentation and they couldn't get the PowerPoint to work. And I was like, okay, well, I'm pretty sure I can figure this out. And they were telling me about what happened. And I said, so what was the specific problem? Oh, she couldn't get the video to play. And I said, oh, I think I know what happened. I said, mm-hmm. Was she using her own computer or did she put a thumb drive in someone else's computer? Oh, we always have everybody put a thumb drive in. I said, I know exactly what happened. She didn't have her videos loaded on the thumb drive. That's what happened. And someone was listening to that and they said, oh, that explains why all these other people couldn't play their videos. And I said, just make sure they have the videos with their presentation on their thumb drive. Because this has happened to me.
Right.
So then at the last Bird Festival I was at, everything was going great except PowerPoint kept crashing every time I would hit play the slideshow. And there was just nothing I could do. Mm-hmm. I tried every tip and trick that I knew and it just wasn't happening. And I thought, okay, everybody just gather around. We're going to huddle together. I know it's like 40 some odd degrees in this building. We're going to huddle together and I'm just going to show you stuff. And I'm prepared to roll with it if I don't have my PowerPoint. But then after that, everybody was just like, yeah, I had a couple more presentations and I called you. And you helped me navigate what had happened. And it was a software problem.
Yeah.
It was the library was corrupt.
The preferences file was corrupt.
But it was the library in the preferences file, wasn't it?
No.
Because I had to go delete that library.
The preferences, which were in the library folder.
That's what it was. Corrupt. Okay. There was corruption in a Microsoft program, if you can imagine. So anyway, we got that fixed. I was like, okay, bada bing, bada boom. I'm going to be good to go for the next day. And everyone was like, okay, I hope this projector is going to work. And I was like, it's not the projector. It was just, it was a problem with PowerPoint. And then everyone kept saying, oh, so it was a hardware problem. No, it was a software problem.
It was a software problem.
But it was just like really interesting. I know so very little about tech. Right. And I was just like, no, that wasn't it. It wasn't, you know, angry weather gods. It was, don't even get me started on the hotel and their Wi-Fi. And I went down and I said, can I be moved to a room closer to your router?
Yeah.
And she said, the Wi-Fi is just bad on cloudy days. And I just looked at her and blinked a few times. And she looked horrified. And I said, I just want a room closer to your router. I think that's going to solve my problem. We don't have any more rooms. I said, okay. And I said, this has nothing to do with your clouds. This is just your router is not going
to
the end of...
You can't reach the cloud.
I don't know that much. I mean, I feel like I know very little about this stuff. And I just always feel like if I'm answering these tech questions, you're... Anyway, I interrupted your ending of this podcast, which I'm really sorry about.
No, you're not. You do it all the time.
I normally wait until you're actually speaking.
Right. So do you have one more thing to bring up?
I won't know yet until you
start
speaking.
This is your big chance. This is Bird Chick Podcast number 169. If you have any questions for Sharon, you can talk to her on Twitter where she is at Bird Chick. If you have questions, you can email her. She is Sharon@birdchick.com. And we'll be back in the nearest future.
Please watch the web series and tell your friends to
watch
it. Yeah,
check out the web series. It's
please,
awesome.
Please, it would make all my sponsors really happy.
We'll have links for the web. We'll have both the videos that are up in this post.
And I got to edit the next video that's supposed to go up this week.
Check it out, nerds. Bye.
Bye.